Okay, well, first of all, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me the opportunity of being back here, which I always enjoy very much. And I would like to warn you that this is meant actually to be a very introductory talk. And since I see in the audience many experts of the subject, they're going to be highly deceived. Okay. So the aim of the talk is actually to give a feeling of what dynamical mean field theory and various improvements or possible improvements on dynamical mean field theory can do, and why it may be useful in various contexts. In particular, the talk is sort of geared at recent efforts to blend this with electronic spectra calculations. So again, it's really an introductory talk, and I'll try to put the problems on the table rather than anything else. So the talk, I'm going to start by reviewing the basics, namely, what is dynamical mean field theory, what is it, and then briefly what it can do for you on simple models like the Hubbard model. And I will, if I have time, show you what it can do on simple models and what it, how well it can do on some comparison to some experiments, mostly on oxides. Okay, that's about half of the talk, I hope, not more than that. And then I'll try to put on the table various issues about going beyond this, and that is more like what can you do for dynamical mean field theory. And these issues, these sort of frontier issues, are basically along two directions. The first one is including what's missing in simple DMFT, namely spatial correlations, and more specifically the dynamical effects of these correlations. I'm sure there will be other talks, in particular by Mark, on this subject in this workshop, but I will just touch upon what the problem is. And then possible ideas about blending DMFT and electronic spectra calculations. Okay. So, first of all, the basics, and this is really very old stuff, but I just want to go through it to okay, so what is DMFT? DMFT is really a local impurity self-consistent approximation to correlated electron lattice models. And the original formulation of this approach really is geared at simple lattice models in which you forgot the original solid and you just wrote something like the Hubbard model, or maybe some multi-orbital version of that if you are ambitious. Okay. And the general idea that proved useful to do something with this dynamical mean field theory is to think of the lattice problem as a collection of sites out of which you are singling out and viewing all the other ones as an external bar. That's the general idea we practice all the time when we do mean field theory for classical stat-mech models, in which we take one site, like if we were doing this for the Ising model, we would take one site, write an effective Hamiltonian for that site, which in this instance is a very, very simple one, just a spin in an external field, and then relate this effective field to the environment by a self-consistency condition, which says that this external field is the average Weiss field seen by that site. And when you combine these two things, a local effective one-side problem and a self-consistency condition, you get an equation for the local magnetization, or alternatively for the local Weiss field, and that's your mean field theory. Okay. So DMFT does exactly the same thing, but it does it for a quantum many-body problem on the lattice. And instead of going through any derivation, I'm just going to put on the projector here the final form of the equations that you get if you look at the single band Hubbard model in some paramagnetic phase, just so that the equations look a little simpler. Okay. So the resulting mean field equations that you get, again, are made out of two parts. One part is a local problem, a single site effective problem, which, however, in this case, turns out to be immensely more complicated than just the spin in an external field. For the single band Hubbard model in the paramagnetic phase, this effective local action is made of two terms, the on-site Hubbard interaction and a retarded term, which basically says that we can take an electron out of the site at a certain time. This electron will wander around in the lattice for a while, and then another electron will come back at a later time, and there is an effective amplitude that I call curly G naught to do this. Okay. So this curly G naught is a function of time, and it should be thought of as some quantum generalization of the Weiss field of usual mean field theory. That's the single side part of the story. What is now needed is a self-consistency condition which relates this effective Weiss field to the rest of the lattice, and that, of course, knows something about which lattice you're on, about the single particle density or states, actually, of the original time-binding model you're working with. And this self-consistency condition takes this form. This may not be the most intuitive form to write it, but it's actually very explicit, so that's what I like. And what this equation is saying is that you just construct that Hilbert transform of the single particle free density of states of your tide binding model. And this Hilbert transform can be inverted. There is a reciprocal function of that Hilbert transform. And then the G naught minus 1 is just given explicitly in terms of I omega n by this formula. And this formula is frequency diagonal. Okay, it couples only, it doesn't couple various frequencies one to the other. So that's quite a simple explicit relation for each frequency, which depends on the lattice you're working on. In contrast, that single size part of the problem is a quite complicated problem. It's one site, but it is still a fully interacting many-body problem with the quartic term and retardation. So this is the set of nonlinear equations that have to be solved in this context. So there is perhaps a more intuitive formulation of these equations, completely equivalent, which is to say that within dynamical mean field theory, there is a self-energy, and this self-energy is only frequency-dependent, doesn't depend on momentum, at least in the paramagnetic phase. Of course, we can access ordered phases within that theory as well, and then, of course, it acquires site dependence. I may touch on that later. But in some uniform phase, it's not momentum-dependent, and that's, of course, something you should scream about. It's a limitation of the method. I come to that in the second part of the talk. And the self-consistency condition I showed you before just tells me that the local side diagonal Green's function, which is the sum over k of this one particle Green's function, can be calculated from an effective impurity model, for an effective single site model, which we require should have, at self-consistency, the same self-energy than the lattice problem. So you can call it a sort of modern version of CPA for interacting systems. I mean, it goes under all sorts of names. But we like to call it dynamical mean field theory because it is really a mean field theory in the sense that you can derive that from a limit in which all spatial fluctuations are actually completely frozen, while all specifically quantum temporal fluctuations are taken into account exactly. So that's why it goes under the name of dynamical mean field theory. Okay. So the nice thing, at least in some people's minds, about this theory is that it's actually controlled in some limit, and that goes back to the very early and pioneering work of Metzner and Wolfhard about 10 years ago. These equations actually become exact in the formal limit of infinite connectivity. Okay, so you can formulate actually the Hubbard model on a lattice of dimension D, say a cubic lattice of dimension D, or any other fancy lattice you may want to think about, like a Bessel lattice with connectivity Z, and take the limit D going to infinity or Z going to infinity. That's not a very physical thing to talk about, in particular in the context of realistic calculation for solids, but for many body theorists, it's actually very reassuring to have a limit in which we know that what we are doing is actually controlled. Yes? Okay, so this question of whether the limit of D going to infinity and any other limit, omega going to zero or whatever, I mean all sorts of other limits you may want to consider in the problem, do commute, okay, is a question which is there in any StatMech problem. Okay? And it has, this question has some formal aspects that I don't think I'm going to discuss in this talk. It also has some physical aspects. For example, you can ask whether going away from this limit, even infinitesimally away, like 1 over d, okay, is a perfectly regular expansion, like it is for the mean filter of a magnet, which we know only becomes singular qualitatively in d equals 4 or something, for some aspects, or whether some new physics is brought in immediately as you expand. Okay, and as I will show you in the second part of the talk, and as we've known for years now, it's clear that new physics actually happens immediately as you expand around this limit. Okay. Now, I don't think that...
You mean by this that there are critical dimensions?
No, that's not what I mean. And if you wait for 20 minutes, I think you'll see more precisely what I mean. Okay. So, these equations become exact in the limit of infinity D, and now the question comes, and that can be shown in various manners. Okay, I'm not going to do that because I don't have time to review all these derivations in this talk, but briefly stated, there are several kinds that are actually useful. One of them is to inspect perturbation theory, to look at perturbation theory in U to all orders, and to discover that actually this perturbation theory for the self-energy becomes local in a certain sense, and that was done very early on by Müller-Hartmann, for example. And another approach to that problem is actually to implement explicitly that idea I was alluding to, namely of focusing on a site and eliminating all the others, and that leads to methods under the name of the cavity method, which lead also to the derivation of these equations. I'm not going to review any of this. Okay. So we have this complicated self-consistent single-site problem, and how can we have a go at it? Well, the progress there came from realizing that this single-site problem for the simplest model, namely the single-Born-Hubbard model, is actually a well-known model. It is a single impurity Anderson model of a magnetic impurity in a host. Okay, so this single-site dynamics can be viewed as a single impurity Anderson model with the self-consistency condition, and I'm just going to very briefly explain this. The single impurity Anderson model is a model of an impurity orbital, usually called D, which is hybridized with some host taken as being free electrons, and if I view the imaginary part of this hybridization function that was there in my single-site effective action as defining the hybridization function for that problem, I can exactly map out this problem onto this single-site effective action that I was showing you before. The only difference between the usual context in which the single site Anderson impurity model is considered, and this DMFT context, is that in the context of magnetic impurity in metals, we know the spectral density of the host. We know this hybridization function. Here, we don't know this hybridization function offhand. We have to calculate it self-consistently. It's as much a part of the problem to be solved than the full interacting lanes function. So you immediately see that any procedure to solve these equations can only be an iterative procedure. You have to solve from some guess for this stabilization function, have some method to calculate the local Green's function, and then use the self-consistency to define a new host stabilization function and iterate until this procedure has converged. Okay. And actually, all the methods that had a go at really solving these equations do use this procedure. Okay, so it's always an iterative procedure in which you start from some guess or whatever initial value for this Weiss field. You use an impurity model solver, which is this line here, to compute the on-site Green's function. Then you feed back this on-site Green's function into the self-consistency condition, get a new G-naught, iterate, and the algorithm actually converges to some solution, which is the solution of your problem. Okay. So, no, it actually cannot be solved exactly, unfortunately. Of course, there are quantum impurity models that have integrable limits. Okay. For example, the one impurity Anderson model that I just talked about is integrable in some special case. Okay. And this special case actually corresponds to a very particular choice of this G-naught. It corresponds to an hybridization function which is flat on all scales. And the model becomes integrable when the cutoff goes to infinity. Okay, then the model becomes integrable. Here, this hybridization function will be a self-consistently determined object, and it will have as much structure as the true interacting spectral density itself. So there is actually very little use, unfortunately, of exact solutions there. Well, that's a good question. Okay, so several people have actually, in the past 7 years or so, have actually developed many different methods to solve that problem. And several of them are actually in the audience. The first algorithm that was actually used to solve that coupled problem quantitatively was quite naturally quantum Monte Carlo algorithms for single impurity problems. Then there's been all kinds of other methods being developed. Some are purely numerical and asymptotically exact methods as you increase the number of your discretization in the limit of an exact description of the problem. These methods actually provide an exact numerical solution. So there's been quantum Monte Carlo, there's been adaptative exact diagonalizations method, there's been Wilson numerical RG, and there's been also some approximate methods that work in some limits or some regions of the phase diagram, like iterated perturbation theory, some projective normalization group, NCA approximation. This problem has been hammered with many, many different methods. Okay. So, for example, the quantum Monte Carlo algorithm, which was first applied to this problem by Mark, is a discretization of your imaginary time slice time interval, okay, using Hubbard's pattern of each field, which are actually discretizing variables on which you sum using Monte Carlo sampling. Okay. And every single of these methods have various kinds of limitations that I'm not going to discuss now, but what really brought progress in the field is actually to have all these methods and compare their results and see that that approximations could be compared to benchmark numerical methods in the field. Okay, so this gives you, I hope, some flavor of what the method is, and now I'm going to briefly describe what it can do concretely on a simple model, the Hartfield Hubbard model, actually, very briefly, and then I'll turn to sort of more challenging issues of going beyond that. Okay, so let me describe, just to give a feeling, some application to the Hubbard model. And actually, I picked this subject, but I could have picked one among tens of others. This method has been used for the Dobbs Hubbard model, it's been used for multi-orbital model, it's been used very nicely for the Anderson and for the Anderson lattice, and so on and so forth. So here I'm going to talk to briefly say a few things about the Hubbard model at hot filling with a semi-circular density of states that you can actually realize on the Bessel lattice. And I'm going to allow for the possibility of having two kind of hoppings, a direct nearest neighbor hopping and a second nearest neighbor hopping, T2. And I'm going to vary, to present you a phase diagram with varying ratio of T2 over T1 for a constant bandwidth, half bandwidth, D. Okay. So that actually is a useful game to play because it allows you to vary the degree of magnetic frustration in the problem. Yes?
Does that mean we should regard this as the solution for the beta coordination
number? I guess so.
And would it be
except it's highly numerical, so...
Would you expect the behavior to be different for...
Okay, so that's actually a good question. This has actually been done also for the cubic lattice. The problem of controlling frustration with the second neighbor hopping has actually not been touched so much on the cubic lattice. There are some subtle differences in the nature of the mod phase on the cubic lattice, that's clear.
That's not true.
But...
The problem of frustration is well known on the hypercubic lattice.
Well,
near neighbor hopping in each axial direction could frustrate the system.
No, sure, you can, of course, do it, but
it's known exactly where that frustration quenches the light for the magnetism. Like
yeah,
one half.
Right, but no, I agree with that. But there hasn't been I don't think there's been a complete, maybe I'm missing some references, but. Has there been a completely detailed study of the phase diagram and the metallic antiferromagnetic phase in the presence of the T2?
Oh, the presence of the T2.
That's what I'm talking about, right?
It's trivial to incorporate the T2.
Yeah, no, I know, it's trivial. It's just, Jan's question was, has it been done and is it different and so on? So the answer is I don't really know. The detail is different, yeah. Qualitatively, I think there isn't much of a difference. Yeah. Okay. So, actually, the phase diagram that comes out for this problem at half filling is some location. Some first is some calculation of the nail temperature as a function of interaction. In the unfrustrated case, well, you get some nail temperature as a function of interaction, which is small, like small and large U, as you would expect. And as you frustrate magnetic order, this boundary is pushed to much lower values, and for an intermediate value of the frustration, you can, first of all, of course, you have a critical U, and you can generate some antiferromagnetic phase here as well. Okay. So that's the fate of the antiferromagnetic solution. And there is, of course, also a story about the paramagnetic solution of this model, namely what's the physics of the paramagnet there. And the first thing that can actually be done is forget about all these ordered phases and study the paramagnetic solution for any temperature. Okay. So many people have done that. And you can always do that in mean field theory because there is always a metastable paramagnetic solution that you can study even though the real ground state would undergo an instability. Okay. So
objection in the reason. I mean, a physical objection can usually interfere. Like, it's not pretty hard to make a frustrated system.
Yes. So, what?
So, what's the reason to make it a fair method, although physics is doing usually anti-fair method?
No, well, you can.
Experimental at finer temperature.
Yes. Exactly. So you can frustrate the antiferromagnetic order with the T2, okay? And then you will see, you can lower actually the nail temperature as much as you want with the T2.
Why do you want to do it?
No. Okay, why do you want to do it is another story. You'll see why I want to do it. I want to do it because the paramagnetic solution has actually quite interesting features which display the mode transition. Okay, so if you are interested in this physics of the mode transition, you may want to do that. If you are not...
You address physics in three dimensions, right? You're claiming that paramagnetic, the mode transition where spin doesn't play any role is of relevance to three dimensions?
No, you're asking me why. What do I think remains of all what I'm going... Well, I'm actually just going to touch on that, but of this mode transition physics in three dimensions, okay? And of course, that's a very... hard question, so I'm not going to answer it. Okay? And I'm not going to answer it now.
The paramagnetic wall is sort of simpler than when you have to spin in and therefore you put on
the... I'm not going to answer it now, okay. But towards the end of the talk, I'll try to pinpoint a few ingredients that indeed show that when you go to finite dimensions, the nature of this mode transition could very well be different. Okay? But nobody has a full answer to this question, I think. Otherwise, you suddenly should give the talk to me.
No, the phase diagrams deal temperature that only you have family equation.
Yeah, you have a family equation. Right.
And the dashed line is a true transition to an antiferromagnetic.
Yes, there is a paramagnetic family liquid, then there is an antiferromagnetic metal, which is also a family liquid. And then there is an antiferromagnetic insulator. So if you actually study, and now I'm going to flash a transparency which has been the subject of many controversies, and let me say that I don't want to enter these controversies here because it's really not the subject of this talk. These controversies actually have to do with some tiny you'll see what I mean. Okay. So. This is the fate of the paramagnetic phase, and the real phase diagram, the physical phase diagram of this model, is really the superimposition of these two things. So for a given degree of frustration, for a given degree of frustration, you should really read this phase diagram as being both the green stuff and the other instabilities. But since it's completely impossible to read, I'm just removing this and explaining the phase of the paramagnetic transition, of the paramagnetic solution. Okay. So at zero temperature, let's first focus on zero temperature. There is actually a phase transition within this paramagnetic solution. At low U, this paramagnetic solution is actually a Fermi liquid metal. And at high U, there is another completely different solution of the paramagnetic DMFT equations, which is a paramagnetic insulator with a gap. Okay. And there is actually some region at zero temperature of coexistence between these two solutions. Okay. So now there is a question of when you go to zero temperature, what happens to these two solutions? This is still the object of some debate in the literature. Again, I'm not going to touch in detail about this in this talk. I personally believe that there is a small region of coexistence of these two solutions with the first order transition, which is this red line, and some other people believe that differently. But I think the zero temperature situation is pretty much under control, and many people would agree with this. Yes.
Is there insulator? Is there perfectly clean gap?
Yes. Right. There is a gap. So I'm going to come. Right. So I'm going to show you some spectral functions now so that you can see exactly what I'm talking about. Actually, there is a local moment, for sure. Yes. And that's actually why, for any model, if you look at the magnetic phase, okay, at low enough temperature, the magnetic phase will always gain, okay? So that's why for any given finite degree of frustration, the kind of phase diagram you come up with is something like this, in which you have an antiferromagnetic insulator, but the incipient paramagnetic insulator is a mass insulator with a local moment and a gap. Okay? But of course, since you have a local moment, this paramagnetic insulator has a huge entropy of order n log 2, and it, quantum mechanics wants to do one thing, which is order it. That's completely clear, and that certainly comes out of this approach.
But I guess the sort of implicit statement is that the charge sector transitions are basically independent from the spin sector transitions, right? That you can really talk about as this and that phase structure, which you call metal insulator, so regardless of what the spin ordering is doing.
No, I don't think...
Or are they coupled?
That's not exactly true, and I hope I will have time to go to this one. I think I will. At the level of one particle quantities within this theory, the precursor effects of ordering are not there. Okay, that's not a nice aspect of this approach. This is a limitation of this approach. Now, at the level of two particle quantities, actually, sure enough, the spin physics comes in. I mean, the correlation, the fact that you want to order comes in, because you'll see some divergent response function. Okay. And that's a very important point, actually, that I will explain more in detail later. Okay, so to answer Warren's question, these are some plots of spectral densities for this metal and then for this insulator. And let me first show you the metallic side. Okay, so, there are various curves that I could show you that have been obtained with various methods. Okay, some have been obtained with the iterated perturbation theory approximation. Others have been obtained, in particular by Mark, by Maxent continuation of quantum Monte Carlo results. I could also show you recent Wilson numerical RG plots. But qualitatively, for the qualitative things I'm going to talk about, they basically are all the same. And this evolution of the spectral function is as follows. In the weakly correlated metal, for zero correlation, you have some semicircle in this case. That's the total K-integrated spectral density. Okay? And as you increase U, you start pulling out some spectral weight from there and putting it at energies roughly plus or minus U over 2. Namely, what you are doing is you are hitting lower and upper Hubbard bands at high energy from a sharper and sharper quasi-particle peak at around the Fermi energy. Okay. So this is the picture in the correlated metal. And then as you go to the transition, the weight of this peak here goes to zero. It actually goes to zero in a continuous manner at the second transition UC2, and a gap opens. Okay? And that's the spectral density at a pretty high value of U, where there is a clean gap at zero temperature and a lower and upper Hubbard band.
So it's still the first order transition,
right? No, this is just...
This is second order.
This is just the metallic solution.
Yeah.
And this is an insulating solution. That's what I'm saying. Okay. So if you follow,
disappearing continuously,
right,
like second order.
Right. So let me exactly explain what I'm saying. If you follow the metal, and you follow the value of Z as a function of U, Z vanishes at some point, and stay at zero temperature at UC2. Okay. And then as you start from the insulator, very high U, and you reduce the value of U, the gap closes somewhere, okay? And it actually closes at a smaller value, okay? So that's what I mean. Now, which of these solutions is better in energy? That you have to compute independently, and it's an exact threshold that at zero temperature, when the metal exists, is always better. Okay, so these are plots of the spectral density. One of the distinctive aspects of this approach, and which makes it actually somewhat useful in comparison to real systems, is that the correlated metal has a pretty rich structure. It has two things. It has both the high energy features, lower and upper Hubbard bands, and it also has correlated low energy quasi-particles which obey all the Fermi liquid requirements. Okay? Because the fixed point of the Anderson impurity model in that regime, when there is when there is density of states at the old frequency, is a Fermi liquid that we've known for decades. Okay. So this theory is actually very good for trying to describe, to account for transfer of spectral weight between low energy quasi-particles and high energy Hubbard bands as you vary something, and this something could be either the degree of correlation or could be temperature, for example, because this is a theory which has excited states built in so that you can study the problem at finite temperature, study thermodynamics and a response function at finite temperature. Okay. On the more theoretical point of view, it's interesting that this mod transition picture has actually two features, two built-in features that are classic in the literature on the mod transition. Namely, on one side, at very low energy, it has features which are very reminiscent from Brinkman-Rice theory, in which some quasi-particle residue, which in this case is also the inverse of the effective mass, goes to zero at the transition. So it is a theory of the mod transition which has heavy quasi-particles very close to the mod transition. Okay. But it's also a theory which has many ingredients of the original mod Hubbard features because we have the closure of the gap and the formation of these high energy bands. And that's actually something which is not easy to get on the same footing in other theories of the mod transition. Okay, so this is basically all I'm going to show you. Maybe I should also flash another thing to convince you that one can calculate actually lots of things in this approach. For example, this is a calculation of the specific heat as a function of temperature of this correlated metal in which you start from the free Fermi gas, and as you increase the degree of correlations, you separate a low energy feature, which is very much like a Kondo peak here, corresponding to this high and higher effective mass, and some feature here at high energy associated with density fluctuation. Okay, so let me briefly touch on very simple-minded comparison to some experiments on oxides and then go to possible improvements and limitations and what are the limitations of this method. So I just mentioned spectral weight transfer. So what I'm actually going to show you is a photo emission experiment on some three-dimensional perovskite, which is a D1 system. So that's actually a little map of the world of three-dimensional perovskite that is due to Fujimori, which I find very convenient. As a function of the filling of the D-shell, the system I'm going to talk about lives here on this line. It's calcium strontium VO3. And it is actually a system in which the vanadium is always in the D1 state. And as you change the calcium-strontium relative concentration, what you are actually doing is changing some relative vanadium-oxygen-vanadium bond angle. So that what you are doing is you are changing the degree of correlation in the system. Well, hopefully that's the only thing you are doing. I guess nobody really knows. Sorry? Yeah, by the way, that's what I'm saying. Relative degree of correlation, U over D.
Correlation.
Sorry. Correlation. Okay. So this is a loop. It's always a metal. It doesn't order. Okay. So, can we understand this correlated metal? Does it have quasi-particles at low energy? Well, it certainly has. Does it have Hubbard bands? Okay. So these are actually the photoemission results. This is angular integrated photoemission results on this system. And this actually also calls for some caution about photo emission experiments, and that's what I like, why I like to show these sometimes. The original results, the photo emission results for calcium VO3, revealed something like this. These were done at helium energies, and they were giving something like that. Okay? So, just looking at this picture, oxygen bands have been actually subtracted. What you see is that there is some quasi-particle at low energy, but this thing has a very tiny spectral weight. So if you stare at these pictures, you would say the spectral weight of the quasi-particles in this system is a 20th or something like that. And that's a very, very correlated metal. And on top of that, it points to very k-dependent self-energy for the following reason, which is that the effective mass as measured from specific heat is actually not so large for this system. So it cannot be given by 1 over the spectral weight. So if that's really the answer, this problem looks very bad for doing the MFT. However, a surprise came a couple of years later on this system, which is that when you increase the photon energy, the spectrum actually changes appreciably. And as you go to more energetic photons, a lot of weight, and so Hubbard band loses some. So actually, you have to have a way to deconvolute between surface and bulk in this experiment. That's quite clear now. And the Japanese and Indian experimental teams that worked on this problem proposed a way to do that. I'm not going to discuss that in any detail.
Why are you saying surface versus bulk?
Well, because...
No,
it's the converse. I mean, as you shoot photons strong enough, you go more into the bulk, right?
You need a proper theory of photo emission.
Yes, which I'm not going to do in the coming 2 minutes, absolutely. But what you definitely need that, okay? However...
More strongly correlated.
Yeah. You're jumping ahead of my talk in my next answer. Sure. Well, that's what these people say. These people say is that if they try to deconvolute the bulk in the surface, they actually have an extremely correlated surface for this material, which actually is completely insulating with no spectral weight there. Okay. And actually, the bulk result that you would extract from that is a correlated metal, but not that correlated. It has, you know, appreciable quasi-particle weight in actually reasonable agreement with the value of the gamma you would measure from specific heat, and it has some lower Hubbard band as well. Yes?
Are there some sources that are correlated, such as oxygen deficiency or...
How do you explain that the surface is an insulator? Yeah, okay, so that's actually a very good question, and there are many possible answers. One, of course, is that the bulk in the surface is actually smaller. I mean, each atom has less coordinates. That's a sort of stupid answer. Then it's clear that impurity effects are more important than the surface. Are defects, you name them. I mean, I don't know. That's what seems to come out of experiments. Okay, so the plane lines that are here are actually DMFT calculations in a very, very simple-minded way. So what has been done here is not electronic structure calculation, is not any ab initio method, it's just taking the one-band Hubbard model for a certain value of U over D, which is fitted to the data, okay, and calculating the spectral function, with a convolution with the experimental resolution, okay? And what you see is that for this moderately correlated metal, you can get a very reasonable agreement. Actually, you can get a reasonable agreement both for the bulk and the surface, taking different values of U over D, okay? And you can do that because in this approach, you have a description of both the quasi-particles and the lower Hubbard band. So what I could show you also is similar fits for the whole sequence calcium strontium VO3 with relative varying concentration of calcium and strontium and how these spectral weight transfers happen. Strontium VO3 is a much weakly correlated metal even.
How different is the U of what you
Well, I don't have the between surface and bulk. Oh, they are very different. They are a factor of more than two. One is below UC, and the other one is above UC. This is the only difference. Again, I wouldn't call that. Yes, I wouldn't call that a model. This is a fit using DMFT, single band Hubbard. Very naive. Okay. So I have about 15 minutes left, I guess. So I'm going to directly jump to limitations and challenges in the field. Okay, so I hope to have convinced you that with DMFT you can do some things. Okay, you can treat quasi-particles and incoherent excitations, you can account for dot phases, you can compute thermodynamics, and for theoretically oriented minds, this is a controlled approximation for large D. And you can get quantitative results. So what is next? Well, there are many things next, and I believe there are actually two sort of frontier directions in this field, and they both are the subject of very active current research. The first one is extending DMFT to include the physics of short-range correlations, and that's actually a very important issue. I will explain why in a minute. And the second challenge in the field is to find an appropriate scheme to blend this method with electronic structure calculation. Maybe for some solids, we actually don't need these extensions, and we would like to have a purely local DMFT, but which takes into account realistic features of materials, or maybe we actually need to do both at the same time. So let me spend 5 minutes on each of these things. I'm first going to explain to you why we have to do that, why it's important, and that is has to do, of course, with what are the limitations of dynamical mean field theory. Okay. So the best way to actually understand these limitations is to think of a very simple, concrete example, which is the TJ model. Okay? And I'm going to go back to the point of view of large D to make things clear. So let's imagine we deal with the TJ model, infinity Hubbard, with some exchange. This exchange in large D has to be scaled by 1 over D. Well, you can play different games, but this is the most natural game. Okay? Well, the hopping is well known, it's scaled as 1 over square root of D. Okay. That is completely consistent, because if you compute a super exchange from that, you're going to get T square over DU. So if you actually deal with this model with DMFT in the disordered phase, in the paramagnetic phase, what you're going to get is that this term completely drops out of the game. Because this term will be treated in the mean field way. It's going to be SI and J. And if there is no local magnetization, there is not this term in the mean field. So DMFT will give for this model some phase diagram like this, very schematically, a long-range order anti-flow magnetic phase of some kind, some paramagnetic phase. This is temperature and doping, okay? But, of course, within this phase, the effect of J is there. Between that phase, J drops out of single particle Green's functions. Okay, so more precisely, you can actually show that the single particle Green's function in the paramagnetic phase is completely J insensitive, while if you look at two particle correlations, and that connects to Jan's question, if you look at two particle correlations, sure enough, it knows about J, and that's how it produces ordering.
So,
well, not exactly, because you will notice here that this is not anything free. This is the U equal infinity Hubbard susceptibility. So in that sense, it takes some RPA form.
So the basic thing that all the spin correlations are popping up into body correlations.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So all those phases are captured by DMFT and by two particle response function within DMFT, but no precursor effect of ordering is seen in the paramagnetic phase. Okay. And the physical reason for that is very clear. Is that because DMFT is actually large D, I should say, is actually separating artificially two scales in the problem. There are actually two scales that we should call the magnetic exchange. One of the scale is the exchange between one site and a given neighbor in a disordered environment, and that's of order 1 over d. And the other scale is actually the coherent exchange between one site and all the shell of neighbors in a magnetically ordered setting, and that's d times j over d of order 1. And these two scales are separated. One goes to 0, the other one is remains order 1. A physical consequence of that in the theory of the mod transition I just showed you is actually precisely the divergence of the effective mass. The physical reason for the divergence of the effective mass in the DMFT theory of the mod transition, which is the same as in Brinkman-Rice, is that the incipient insulating paramagnetic mod state has n log 2 entropy, as we discussed. Okay? And at the coherent scale for, say, the weakly doped metal, okay, we have to retrieve that entropy. So the effective mass, which is basically this slope, should be of order 1 over delta, and will diverge like 1 over doping. However, in a real system, it's quite clear that even in the paramagnetic metal, even in the paramagnetic insulator, the exchange is there to quench part of this entropy. So this is certainly a reasonable estimate, provided that this coherent scale is actually bigger than J. And the J I should put there is actually the J scale in the disordered state, which is of order 1 over D. Okay? So that means that as long as Jij, which is T squared over Ud, is smaller than T delta, this theory is fine. It's probably a good approximation. Okay? But however, when T delta in the very low doping regime becomes smaller than T squared over Ud, then we are in trouble, and these dynamical effects of the Jij are actually playing a crucial role. Okay. And we know that. We've known that for a very long time, for example, from large N theories. Large N theories tell you that actually the effective mass, well, I should write it on the board. I can't find my transparency. The effective mass close to the mod transition N star over M is actually something like 1 over doping plus J over T, but this J is really J over TD. Okay. So that actually has a bearing on one of Claudio's questions. It's quite clear when you look at this expression that if you were attempting 1 over D expansions, you would see that at small doping, there is a singularity of this expansion. This has a highly singular expansion in 1 over D. And the reason is that new physics is coming in, and this new physics is precisely that. So what can you do, what can we do about that, beyond the MFT, of course? Well, there are many possibilities. I'm just going to mention some of them, and I'm sure there will be talks in this workshop. Of course, you could be saying, well, actually, we won't. If we are really interested in a phase which has a large correlation length, why not caricature it within the MFT as a long-range ordered phase? And that's perfectly okay, maybe, for some problems. Actually, there has been some recent work of the mod transition between the antiferromagnetic metal and the antiferromagnetic insulator along these lines. But if you really want to deal with the paramagnetic phase, it's been clear for a while that rather than attempting 1 over D, what you should really do is plug in this physics of the local exchange. And the natural idea in this context is to extend the single side dynamical mean field theory to some kind of cluster dynamical mean field theory. There's been early attempts to do that by Schiller and Ingerstent and by Cotillard and myself. And these attempts were facing a well-known problem, well-known from the early times of coherent potential approximation for localization, which is nobody tells you that what you are doing is a consistent scheme. In particular, you don't have large D to tell you that anymore. It's becoming a little bit of art, okay, rather than a control limit. And in particular, what you get is that if you pick one cluster scheme out of many possible ones, chances are you are going to get a scheme which violates spectral positivity rules. So the self-energy is not going to be analytic, and so on and so forth. However, there are some recently proposed cluster approximation schemes which seem to have overcome this problem, and I'm sure Mark will be talking about it here, the so-called dynamical cluster approximation. And these schemes, of course, will bring in multi-impurity physics and that physics of the local correlations. Okay. Now, why do we care about all these things? Well, certainly for systems which have highly frustrated magnetism, for some reason, for example, in 3D oxides, most probably because of orbital fluctuations, we may not care so much. But for systems in which the correlation lengths are actually somewhat big, we certainly care a lot. And an outstanding problem of that kind is, of course, the pseudo-gap issue in HTC. And also the competition between RKKY and Kondo in Kondo lattices. Okay. I just also want to draw your attention to one thing, which is that in models which have bound randomness, the natural, so this is a sort of side comment, but in models which have a bound randomness, like spin glasses, the natural scaling of the exchange is actually 1 over square root of D, and then that physics of the competition between the formation of heavy quasi-particles and the spin fluctuations is built in already at the D equal infinity level. And there's been many works in the past 2-3 years on quantum spin glasses and doped quantum spin glasses by various people, including myself, which investigated that problem. Okay. So...
saying is that it's highly non-trivial in the infinity.
Sorry? What?
So that problem becomes highly non-trivial.
Yes, yes, absolutely. So for example, okay, let me just make a side comment on that. For example, the quantum spin glass model in infinite D, just if you want, solving the quantum Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model of a spin glass, is still an open problem for the SU2 case. Okay. Very recently, we've been able to, with Subir Sajdev and a student of mine, Olivier Parcollet, we've been able to actually solve this problem in the large N limit. So there is a mean filter of the quantum Heisenberg spin glass. That's a paper I put on the net last week, actually, using this 1 over square root of the kind of scale. So do I have 5 minutes? Or? Yeah. Okay. So this was the first challenge I mentioned, namely, including the effect of short-range correlations. Let me actually just flash one transparency about the other one, which is blending the MFT and electronic structure calculations, and briefly mention what has been done and what may remain to be done. So it's actually a very tempting idea, and the simplest route you may think to follow to do this is, well, simplest in principle, is to keep DMFT as a theory for effective Hamiltonians. Okay. So the first thing you have to do is to solve for electronic structure using LDA or LDA plus U, and then map that onto an effective time-binding Hamiltonian plus some U-turns. Of course, this Hamiltonian will have many orbitals and so on and so forth. Okay. And then treat this Hamiltonian, this tide-binding Hamiltonian with U's, using DMFT. Okay. And Vladimir Anisimov has presented to us results, well, not results, actually. I have time to present results. I have some of your results here. Doing this for systems like lanthanum strontium titanium oxide with quite a bit of success. Of course, there are two difficulties along this route. Okay, one of the difficulties, I would say a technical difficulty, but it's very serious, is that if we have to deal with tide binding models with many orbitals, we have to have good multi-orbital impurity model solvers. Okay, and that's not simple. you can do quantum Monte Carlo. People have done that, in particular Sascha Lichtenstein with many orbitals. You can see it, but very quickly you are limited. Okay, so finding new approximate or new schemes or new algorithms to solve quantum impurity models with many orbitals per on the you are considering is certainly a technical challenge in the field, and that's something we should think about. Okay. Now there is a more ab initio problem along this route, which is that of course you are splitting the problem in two halves. The first half you do LDA plus U, and then you do the MFT. And so you are repeating in some manner twice the same thing in the way you treat correlations, because of course LDA plus U has some amount of correlations. Okay. So it's not quite clear really how things go in this splitting. And one would certainly like to think about a more ab initio blending of these two methods. Namely, and that actually connects to one of Jan's questions during Vladimir's talk, which is, can we work from the start on the inhomogeneous electron gas as we have in the solid and devise some local scheme in terms of the local Green's function? Can we construct an exact local Green's function functional scheme? Okay. And actually, there are some ideas around on that. I have some recent work in which I tried to construct such a functional, and I was hoping to show some of that today, but I won't. The problem is that there is actually a way to do that, but it's not only enough to have a formal construction of such a generalized DFT theory, you also need to have a practical scheme with which you can calculate, and that's certainly not there yet, so this is an important direction for further improvement. Okay, thank you.